Welcome to a Listen to Older Voices Golden Moments program. I'm brought to you through the Toorak Times. This is a repeat program from our archives that we believe has merit enough to rebroadcast so that the story and the person's life can be shared with those who may have missed it the first time. Hello, I'm Rob Greaves and this is Listen to Older Voices, where, on this program, I present part one of a three-part program on the life and times of Nick Ordinance. Born in 1950 in Staffordshire, England, Nick was brought up on his family's pig farm, where his affinity for animals began. At 9 years of age, his parents separated and Nick was brought up by his father. We learn of his father's German-Polish background, and this alone is a fascinating story. The young Nick moves from the country to the city, where the smog was so bad he had to wear a scarf over his face and at times could barely see more than a few metres. School wasn't a terrific experience, and Nick explains why, but for all of that he did very well, winning a scholarship to a school mainly populated by the children of the well-off. He did, however, join the cadets, something he really enjoyed. Loving economics, he joined Lloyd's Bank, but after a little more than 2 years he left and became a bus conductor, before becoming a zookeeper, and here the story really begins. Now, here's Nick. Well, Nick, first of all, thank you very much for agreeing to speak with me.
You're welcome.
And could I start by asking you, when were you born and where were you born?
I was born in 1950 in Stafford, in Staffordshire in England.
Okay. Well, we get a lot of English people on the program, not surprisingly. Staffordshire, tell us a little bit about Staffordshire. What sort of country is it?
Well, I mean, I left when I was fairly young, in my teens, but my memories of it were basically initially farmland, because my father was a farmer, a farmhand, so I grew up on a pig farm, actually. But then when it was time to go to school, we moved into Wolverhampton. The edges of Wolverhampton, because he started to work at the Goodyear tyre factory. So my overreaching memory of that particular time is smog. I can remember having to go to school. When I got to secondary school, I used to have to travel by bus, and the smog was yellow, a deep, thick yellow colour, and so thick that I used to have to wear a scarf wrapped around my face to stop coughing. And I can recall that you couldn't see the numbers of the bus coming through the smog, so I had to stand in the road in front of the bus so I could desperately wave. You know, by the time I'd realised that was the bus I was supposed to be catching to get to school. So they call it the Black Country, and that's because of the, you know, the, all the industry and what happened. It goes on around there, yeah. So those are my long memories of Wolverhampton, yes.
Talk about memories. What are your earliest memories?
My earliest memory, my wife and I often have this conversation because she swears she can remember people looking at her in the pram, which apparently is quite rare because I certainly don't. My first memory is being on the pig farm. My father, as I say, was a farmhand, and I used to ride the pigs. It was a free-range pig farm, and every morning I would walk up to the fields and the pigs would come over to me. I'd get on their back, they'd run around the field, and then when they'd had enough, they'd take me over to a hay barn and dump me in the barn and leave me there, so that was fine. And I was so young and naive, of course, I didn't know what was happening to the pigs. There was this shed where they disappeared, which I never knew. I've never eaten pork in my life. And also there was a German shepherd called Rex. And the first photograph that I've got of me is 3 years old. I'm standing at a certain height and Rex is about 6 inches taller than I am. And his owners are sitting 20 feet away watching the photograph being taken because nobody could approach this dog. He was kept locked in a cage at all times because he was so dangerous, apparently. But of course, with the innocence of youth, I thought no better. And so I loved him to death and he loved me. They put him down eventually, I discovered many years later, and got this horrible snappy little thing to replace him. But it obviously, as they say, your brain's malleable at that age, because I've had German Shepherds ever since. Every dog I've had has been a German Shepherd. I love them.
It was obviously a wonderful experience with Rex. Yes. Tell us about Mum. What was Mum like?
Well, Mum, again, I have little memory. Unfortunately, she left when I was nine. My parents separated when I was nine. So my memories of her as I was a child are fairly dim and distant. I can remember being taken to the hospital when I was 3 years old, and she had a blue coat on and she had this bundle in her arms and she said, "This is your new brother." and I can remember beating him up in the pram because I was jealous of him and being told off. But then I don't remember. I remember a lot of arguments. My parents disagreed for many years before they finally decided to separate, so that's gone. And I didn't see her again until I got to Australia in 82, and I've got an aunt in Sydney, and I don't know how exactly, I forget now, my mother found out where I was and asked if she'd come and visit, so I've been seeing her ever since. So she came to see me in about 83, so we've been seeing her every couple of years since then.
So obviously went well.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. So from 1959 to 1983, so now we're the best of friends, you know. And
that was great.
Yeah, she texts me. She can't email, but she's learned how to text. So every other day I get, "Hi son, how you going?"
Oh, how lovely. So that's terrific, yeah.
And interestingly too, because she remarried after my parents divorced, which I didn't know about, 15 years ago, I discovered 3 half sisters and 2 half brothers I didn't know I had, and they're great too. And wow. A niece, so whole family that I didn't know existed.
Exactly.
So that was interesting, especially as I always thought of myself as a non-family person, you see. My parents divorced, my father died when I was 28, and so I've been living on my own since I was about 15, and always thought families were just something other people had, so always very distant.
So it was just you and Dad then when your mum left, was it?
And my brother.
I've
got a brother, but he and I haven't spoken for 25 years, and then he rang me up about 2 years ago and said, "Oh, it's probably time we got together." I said, "Yeah, if you like." So he came over and we got on again like a house on fire, but our slightly strange upbringing made us a little bit insular.
Yes.
So it wasn't that we didn't like each other, we just never really communicated.
So what was it like for you then, living basically just with Dad and your brother? I mean, I guess that was a very difficult question, given you didn't know what it's like to have a mother during that period. Was it difficult for you, or did you just adapt easily?
I think the first year or so were fairly hard because we were young. I was 9, my brother was 7. I remember we cried a lot, you know, because where's mum, this sort of thing, because there was no sort of explanation of that. And my father was wonderful. I mean, he was unheard of. I can remember the local pastor, as they would call them, came to visit, knocking on the door. "We're very concerned, Mr. Ordinance, about your children. Now your wife's not here." And my father was a very, very independent man. I'll tell you his story later. It's too long to encapsulate in this. But he said, basically, sit down, and gave him a lecture about how they were his children and nothing was going to happen and he would look after them, blah, blah, which he did. But unfortunately, he died at 54.
So that was young.
Yeah, very young. He had, apparently, because I've discovered I've got genetically high cholesterol, so he must have done too. Plus, he smoked and he ate. He was born in Germany of Polish parents, so he ate the most disgusting food imaginable, all fat and stuff and blah, blah. So he had a heart attack at 54 and died.
Well, time's not our enemy, Nick, so could you tell us a bit more about your dad?
My father was born in Mannheim in Germany. And his mother was a Polish Jew, and his father was probably a Polish Jew, but he was born in Russia because, of course, in those days, Poland didn't exist. So he was born in a town that was called Russia, but may have been Poland. They divorced. My grandmother was my grandfather's 4th wife. My father was the only child that he knew of. We'll get to that later. I believe he died August 1939. She said to him, "You got to get out of here. This isn't looking good." She sent him to England to supposedly enrol in agricultural college. Within a month of arriving, of course, war broke out and he was put into an internment camp as an alien. And after a while, he was let out because obviously he wasn't, A, he was of Jewish ancestry, B, he wasn't German, but he happened to have been born in Germany.
Yes.
So he became a farmhand and he worked in, you know, rubbish conditions as a farmhand, saved up a year to buy himself a pair of shoes because he used to walk around with rags on his feet.
Wow.
1 pair of shoes, 5 shillings in the local shop. They were too big, but he bought them anyway and stuffed them with newspapers, you know. Anyway, he joined the Home Guard and he got a phone call one day, "Go to London, somebody wants to see you in London." So as he said, he was a private in the Home Guard. He walked into this building, he came out a lieutenant in the military intelligence, spent the rest of the war as a spy because he spoke fluent German, obviously. So he'd interrogate prisoners. They would pretend he was a prisoner and put him in prisoner of war camps. And so he would listen to what was being said and report on that. And that's the bits he told me. I don't know anymore. He was very close-mouthed about it. He told me all about the unarmed combat he'd learnt and how to shoot and parachute out of planes and all this sort of stuff. So at the end of the war, in recognition, he was given British citizenship, you know, for his services, blah, blah. And I remember sometime in the 60s, he walked in one day and said, "Look, Nick, it's the first passport I've ever had." He applied for his British passport because he was stateless, because in Germany, it was Nazi Germany, he wasn't classified as German.
No.
His parents weren't German, even though he played international soccer for the German football team.
One suspects if he'd stayed, that wouldn't have counted for
nothing.
Wouldn't have counted for anything.
Not at all.
Right.
But he actually had a certificate saying he'd played schoolboy international for Germany. because he played good football and he was fairly blonde with, you know, not blue eyes, but he was a good-looking guy. But once the things got heavy, of course, he would have been classified
absolutely
as Jewish, both Jews. So, yeah, he stayed in England. Didn't tell me this, he was 15, mind. Sat me down when I was 15 and said, oh, I should tell you I never spoke a word of English till I was 15, because he was frightened that we'd be ostracised just there because I was born in 50, so soon after the war.
Very close, yes, yeah, that's
so
right.
He thought probably not a good thing. I've cursed him ever since because I could have been bilingual. He could have been teaching me German from the grave because I'm terrible at languages, you see, and the easiest way to learn, anyway.
Can you go back to into your mind, you know, about the time when he told you as a 15-year-old? Was this something that was startling, or was it just another story your father told you?
No, my brother and I were sneaks, and he didn't used to tell stories, but we used to search the house on a regular basis, and we found all these documents, so we knew something was going on, but we didn't want to intrude, so we waited for him to tell us. Since they've disappeared, I asked my brother to find them. He says he can't find them.
Oh, how sad.
I think my dad must have burnt them, you know, because he was so wanting to be English, I think, at that stage. Although, go on holiday, see a German tourist, he was off like a shot. I'll just go and practice my German, and I'll be back in an hour, you know, blah, blah, blah. Meanwhile, his mother, back in Mannheim, I've since discovered I got onto the Red Cross, because since my brother and I got together, we've done a lot more research. So 1940, the SS rounded up all the Jews in Mannheim and sent them to Vichy, France, you know, who they were collaborating, and they'd set up two camps in Vichy. She stayed there till 42, and then the Gestapo said, no, that's enough of this, went over there and took them all to Auschwitz.
And,
so she died there. We then discovered that Ordinans, my surname, which is originally Latin, but in Polish it's spelt with a Y. Means the same thing. It means like assistant. In Polish, it means Batman, you know, military.
Oh, okay, yes.
So we finally got on to Yad Vashem, which is the Jewish Holocaust organization in Israel, and typed in Ordinans, and there were over 200 Ordinans in a town called Łódź in Poland, spelled L-O-D-Z, but pronounced Łódź in Poland. It's a silk weaving type area, which we know my grandfather was a silken wool weaver. Over 200 of them there in 1939 and about three in 1945. So that's why, to my knowledge, there are four Ordinans in the world.
Wow. Would I be right in saying that you're very much into history?
I'm a great student of history, and the problem is that the majority of history is written by leaders, commanders, blah, blah, blah. In fact, the people that are involved, that's why I'm a big fan of military history. So I read a lot of stuff like John Keegan, who does individual interviews with just like The Face of Battle, best book ever written. It's just individual soldiers
right. And
their memory. So finding out what somebody, you know, a private in the trenches felt like in the Somme is far more fascinating than listening to bloody Kitchener, who was back in London.
Absolutely.
Saying, this happened. That's not the Somme at all. It's rubbish, you know. It is the story of millions of individuals.
Absolutely. And the sad thing is that most of those individuals never get a chance to recount
exactly.
their experiences.
No.
And this is Listen to Older Voices. Ageless stories on Ageless Radio. I'm Rob Greaves, and I'm talking with Nick Ordinance.
And the internet's there, because that's only how I found this ad. And I found one in America through the internet. And he came over to visit us a few years ago. He thought he was the only Ordinance in the world till I found him up here. My grandfather went over there in 1911, left his son there, decided he hated it, went back to Germany and married my grandmother. Meanwhile, the child at 13 that he dumped in America grew up, became a Catholic, married and produced an Ordinance family over there who, at 60-odd, he finally discovered me, a cousin.
So how many are there at the moment, do you know of?
Well, over there, there's a few of them.
There's a few now,
they've bred,
yes.
So there's like 12 of them, because they've got wives and all this sort of, but originals, you know, the originals,
yes.
There's me, there's my brother, there's Marty in Wisconsin, and on Facebook, I discovered one in Israel, but he only speaks Hebrew, so we're having difficulty communicating. So that's four that I know of.
That's really, that is seriously remarkable, because there's not many people with a surname where you could only say, look, there's only four originals that left.
Well, in all my world travelling, before the internet, every time I got to any city, I would open the phone book. See, now I just do a vanity search on Google, and all I ever got was me, Nicholas J. Ordinance, and the latest TV show he'd been on because of the sanctuary or my books or what have you. And then one day, this name, Karen Ordinance, came up. I almost had a heart attack on the spot, you know. It'd never been an ordinance that I wasn't related to, me or my brother or Elizabeth. And so, anyway, I tracked down, again, the internet, tracked down the social security records, tracked down the telephone books, got them, rang up. Hi, Marty Ordinance, yeah. I know this will sound strange. What was the name of your grandfather? He went, Morris. I said, so was mine.
Wow.
He almost collapsed on the spot.
I was going to say, what was his response?
He said, I'm just going out, I can't cope. It was like 10 o'clock. Anyway, he went out and then he got his daughter to email me the next day and we communicated.
Of course.
And emailed and wrote, and as I say, Marty said, I've got to meet you. And he and his two sons came over and spent a couple of weeks here with my wife and I had a lovely time.
So, gee.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? We've got nothing in common. Don't even look like each other. But the name, you know, to spend 60-odd years of his life thinking he was the only ordinance in the world.
Are you able to sort of track back to the common point?
No. The furthest we've got back is, so the trouble is my grandmother, we don't even know where she came from before Mannheim. She was a stateless Pole before that. Moritz, the only reason we know anything about him is because literally in the last 12 months we've managed to track down the documents of him leaving the ship in New York. In Canada, and crossing into New York. That's the only documentation that exists. Prior to that, all I had was my dad's word that this was his name and a tiny little photograph he brought over with him from Germany. But we found it. We knew he went to America, and my father-in-law was terrific. He's on Ancestry.com. He's got membership, and he researches for me, and he sent me this email, and woof, suddenly this whole history. But that's it. Moritz, my grandfather, that's as far as it goes. See, because all my grandparents were dead before I was born, literally all of them, on my mother's side too, because of the war. You know, either killed in the war. My mother's father was killed at Gibraltar in a ship. Yeah, my mother's father was killed at Gibraltar in a ship. He was in the Royal Navy, so he died in the Second World War. We've already said both my father's parents did, and my mother's mother died in 1949, the year before I was born, just as she and my father were about to emigrate to Australia. And they stayed in England because she died, so I could have been Australian years ago.
Yeah, could have.
So overall, you'd say things were okay for you with your dad as a young boy?
Yeah, we got on fine. I think probably my only overriding, which is very selfish, memory of being a young boy is the embarrassment, you know, being at school of, can you get your mother to do this? Can you get your mother to sew this little uniform for the school play? And I'd have to creep aside with the teacher and say, I haven't got a mum, I can't get it sewed, you know. Felt a little bit like a charity case.
Sure you did. But, yeah. What about the other kids? Did they make anything of this at school?
No. Actually, I'd have to say, in all fairness, I never had any feedback about that at all. Everybody knew. But as I said, we're talking 1959, you know, separation, divorce was still an unusual thing
in that place and that time.
It wasn't common. But no, everybody was very good about it. I don't recall any stigma or anything at school or anything like that, you know.
So. Did you enjoy school?
Hated it with a passion, absolutely, especially my second school. I got a sort of scholarship. There's a private school in Wolverhampton called just the Wolverhampton School. It was established in 1512, so it's one of the oldest schools around. And my first year there was spent doing no learning whatsoever but preparing for the Queen, because she was coming for the 450th anniversary of the school. So for 12 months all we did was practice and practice and practice, and the teachers all went round in mortarboards and gowns and beat the kids, you know. They all had canes, and there were a few cases of inappropriate behaviour for some of the boys locked in studies and what have you, and I hated them. They were disgusting people,
I thought. No wonder.
Yeah, horrible, horrible people. And my brother came. He managed to get a scholarship too, and unfortunately he was, at that being significantly younger than me, started to react a little to what had happened, and he played up a little bit, and he got in a minor problem with the police, and the school expelled him. We can't have this kind of child at our school. And I was 16, so I thought, to hell with it, and I quit. I left. I thought, I'll go and start my life outside school. I never really enjoyed it, and had a very biased view of school teachers for a long time after that, I have to say. I've since met a lot of modern school teachers, are of course a completely different breed. But basically, I thought the majority of the teachers at this school were sadistic, I have to say.
It sounds as though... Mm. Was it a church-based school?
It wasn't at all. No, it was founded by merchant travellers. There were a bunch of, you know, these guys in the Middle Ages who would established trading routes and what have you, and they decided that they wanted to make this school. And the main building where we had the morning assemblies had huge stained glass windows in it, and each one was a picture of one of the... It was very much like Hogwarts.
Oh,
seriously,
right.
Without the magic, there was no magic whatsoever.
No magic.
And each of the houses that you had to belong to, which you were randomly chosen, again, not by the hat, but by the teachers, was named after one of the founders, and I was in Jennings. Jennings was one of the...
As of the industrial spinning Jennings.
Exactly. Right. And also there were... they had a military cadet scheme. You had to, from 13 onwards, you had to... it was compulsory. Every Wednesday you had to be in uniform and do all that sort of stuff and go off to camps in the summer.
You didn't enjoy that?
I loved that.
I learned to shoot.
I'm a big gunman. Don't shoot anything living, but I love firearms and love shooting. And I learned to shoot. I got able to shoot a 22 rifle, a Lee Enfield 303, and on camps we were shooting machine guns and Bren guns. It was
oh, I mean, that's paradise, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I loved it. This is me. And then I developed a love for pan guns, and that became my big interest from then onwards. But yeah, that was the one part I did enjoy. I have to, apart from the pressing your uniforms. And, yeah.
Did you have much of a life outside of home and school? Did you have friends that you hang out with, or were you a loner?
No, I think I've always been a loner pretty well. I had a couple of school friends I used to see. The problem is the school I was at was mainly, because it was a fee-paying school, most of the kids were rich,
right.
And we weren't. Yes. As I say, we were a scholarship. I was laughingly telling my wife about the parents coming to pick their kids up in their Rolls-Royces and their Mercedes, and my dad would turn up in his Austin A30, you know, and would laugh. And by the time they were 17, the majority of the kids were driving themselves to school in Jaguars, you know. So there were a couple of kids I got on with, but...
Your dad must have had to have given up a bit to being able to afford to send you there then.
It was all scholarships. All
paid. Oh, scholarships.
Yeah. We got it because I was one of the highest two, what they called 11 plus in those days. I was one of the top three kids in the county. And so therefore, yeah, you can go to this school, you know, that's it, blah, blah. And paid for all he had to pay for was uniform and books. That was it. So he was working three jobs at the time anyway because he was determined to retire when he was 55. Unfortunately, he died a year before that, but he was piling away as much money as he could so he could retire early. So,
and this is Listen to Older Voices, the program that presents the stories of everyday Australians through the recollection of their life.
So what age did you leave school?
16.
And what did you do?
I became a bank clerk. The only class that I enjoyed at school, when I passed my O-levels, and to do the A-levels, which is, you know, the final stage before you go to university, you had to choose your subjects, I was fascinated with history. Hence our earlier discussion about history. I loved history. So I went into what they call sixth history, which was history, geography, and you had a third choice. I chose economics, which was being taught for the first time ever that year that I chose it. My economics teacher was brilliant. He was the best teacher I'd ever had. I really, really liked him. And he hated the school so much, he only lasted a term, unfortunately. So he left, and we were every economics class from that moment on was a teacher coming in and say, okay, read this chapter of this book, because nobody knew anything about economics. But it sort of fired an interest in me.
Right.
And so I convinced myself I was going to be this banking magnate. So I got a junior job with Lloyds Bank and did that for 2.5 years until I woke up one day. And by this time, I'd made a friend. I'd joined a pistol shooting club. And I became friends with a young man named Gary Davis. And he and I were like blood brothers for years. We were completely off the planet. We lived entirely through Western movies and Clint Eastwood and the guns and all this. I think we were in this sort of little fantasy world, but he was the best friend I'd ever had for a long, long time. We had this vision we were going to go world traveling, you see. So I left the bank and got a job as a bus conductor.
Now, a lot more how money. Old are you here?
17,
so this is about 1967.
Yes, yeah. 67, 68, yeah.
Now, that's a bit of a turnaround, isn't it, from yeah. being a merchant banker into yeah. a bus
yeah,
conductor?
Yes, absolutely, and that changed my life because from then I thought, no, I'm going to do what I feel like doing. I'd realised the banking wasn't really me. So I did various jobs, and I did a few trips overseas, did a few things. I had about 27 jobs by the time I was 20.
And which you could do in those days,
yeah,
couldn't you? You
absolutely.
Can't do that today. Kids, any young person listening now would go, you're making that up.
No, not at all. My father got me a job at Goodyear's, the tyre factory, where he'd worked for years, said, you'll love this, it's great pay. I went the first day. The second day I turned up, and our job was entirely loading and unloading wheels off trucks, huge, great 300-weight wheels, you know, which wouldn't be allowed now. Very, very tiring work. And anyway, I arrived in the morning. It was freezing cold. I'd still got my combat jacket on. All we could do was load the wheels. When they arrived, there weren't any wheels. So we're sitting, standing, and the foreman came up to me and said, why haven't you got your jacket off here? I said, because it's still cold. He said, but you're standing around doing nothing. I said, because there's nothing to do. I'm waiting for something to load. He said, well, this is ridiculous. I've had this. I'm leaving. He said, you can't leave. You've clocked on. So I said, okay, I've clocked off. So that was a day and a half. And that was one of my shortest jobs. And anyway, I bummed around and I came back from overseas, decided I was going to become a fireman. applied to be a fireman, got to the interview, and they said, you should have told us you've got glasses, you can't wear glasses because of the breathing apparatus, you see.
Oh, of course.
So I thought, what am I going to do now? And my friend and I are very interested in animals, so I lived in the Midlands. I rang up Dudley Zoo, the local zoo, and said, oh, you know, do you ever employ people? Because you never saw ads for zookeepers. Mm. And the lady said, oh, actually, we're looking for a new keeper. Come for an interview on Friday. If she said no, I would have thought, oh, well, end of that, and got off to do something else. Went for the interview with the German curator. He rang me up on the... He said, I've got a couple of other people to see. Ring me Friday night. I rang him Friday night. I said, can you start Saturday morning?
Wow.
That was 30 years of my life gone.
Was that a moment of excitement for you? Did you feel this was something different?
Well, I'll tell you the moment of excitement. This was the zoo I'd visited as a child.
Right.
There's photographs of me at 2-3 years age walking with my mum and her sister around the zoo. And one of the things I can remember seeing all the time was the giraffes. You sit there, you look at them, aren't they cute? You know, blah, blah, blah. My first day, I walked in. Oh, come on, we're going to go and do the giraffes. Fine. Amazing how big they look from the other side. When you're in with them, that was the amazing moment, because I thought I was going to look after, you know, lions and tigers and big, dangerous animals. And I stood there shivering because the guy who gave me a bucket and said, go and put the food in a tray. I said, but she's up again. How do I get past? She'll kick me to death. He said, just walk. So I eased my way past, you know, and poured the food into the bucket, and she leaned down and licked me with this most amazing tongue. Well, she smelt me first, this beautiful warm breath over my face, and then licked me at the face. And I think my grin, you know, to be a cliche, would have split my face wide open. And I was in love from that moment onwards. That was it.
Join Nick and I next week for part two of his story, where he demonstrates his abilities as a true storyteller when he continues his story of his fabulous career as an animal carer stroke zookeeper. And we learn how it was that he came to be in Australia and how he made a real impact at the Hillsville Sanctuary. Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Wesley Mission Victoria. The program is supported by financial assistance from the Commonwealth Government through the Commonwealth Home Support Program and is brought to you through the Toorak Times.